The recording has started.
Wonderful. Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the 35th GNSO ePDP team meeting taking place on the 18th of December 2018 at 1400 UTC. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the telephone bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? And as a reminder, we do have Hadia noted on audio only. Anyone else in addition?
This is Mark. I'm on audio now, but I should be joining Adobe shortly.
Thank you, Mark. Hearing no one further, we have apologies listed from Diane Plout, of IPC, Emily Taylor of RRSG, Thomas Rickard of ISPCP, and Marika Koning staff. They have formally assigned Brian King and Sarah Wild as their alternate for this meeting and any remaining days of absence. During this period, the members will have read-only rights and no access to conference calls. Their alternates will have posting rights and access to conference calls until the members' return date. As a reminder, the alternate assignment form must be completed by the Google assignment form. The link is available in the agenda pod to the right and also in the meeting invite email. Statements of interest must be kept up to date. If anyone has any updates to share, please raise your hand or speak up now. Seeing or hearing no one, if you need assistance updating your statements of interest, please email the GNSO Secretariat. All documentation and information can be found on the ePDP Wiki space. There is an audio cast and view only Adobe Connect for non-members to follow the call, so please remember to state your name before speaking. Recordings will be circulated on the mailing list and posted on the public Wiki space shortly after the end of the call. With this, I'll now turn it back over to our chair, Kurt Pritz. Please begin.
Thanks very much, Terry. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for the on-time start. To go into the welcome and updates, I think we'll skip down and talk about the legal questions team. They're going to have their first meeting tomorrow right at this time. So that meeting will occur then. Barry or someone from the team, can you put up the members of the team? And I'll an agenda will go out later today. But I think, and we can discuss this for a minute if you want, we should start with the list of questions that are extracted from the initial report, where the initial report indicated we were going to get legal advice on these questions. And I think, the initial report actually says that we're going to solicit this information from the Data Protection Board, but we've since decided we're going to go elsewhere with these questions. So with that in mind, the agenda, I think, will be for us to take those questions as exactly as written in the initial report. Consider how they can best be worded to solicit the right kind of legal advice. So I think that'll be the agenda for the meeting. There'll be a process part of the meeting before where we reiterate the process through which this legal team go to receive questions, pound them into shape, get review the questions with the rest of the team before they go out, and then get sent out for answer. So there'll be a process part of the meeting where we'll reiterate our process for how we're going to operate, and then go on to some substantive portion. So I think that's the agenda for the meeting. I'm kind of looking for through the chat, Barry or someone from staff, if you could put up the list of members, that'd be good. Caboose, I see you're in the queue. How you doing, Caboose?
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I have one question and one comment. The question that I raised already and I received no answer is that who wrote this qualification and criteria for the legal team, that they must be attorney and they must have legal basis? Does it mean that every attorney could give a good legal advice? I know many that they don't know anything at all. They just got from their school and have some paper showing that they are attorneys. So does it mean that other people that does not have that sort of certificate are not allowed to have any legal statement or legal qualifications or legal analysis or anything? And who wrote this criteria? I would like to know who has written this criteria that this should be. So I have no problem with these people selected, although I don't agree with some of them, but I don't want to delay the situation. But I don't understand that somebody writing qualification for a group. We are members and all of us eligible to participate voluntarily in the legal issues and legal group. I have been working in many legal areas for years and years, and I have written convention, constitution, charter for many organizations, and I don't understand that why the people just refer to the attorney or to have legal experience and so on. Who select these people? Thank you. This is the first question. The comments. Kurt, we are a group of people. We get together to solve a problem or suggest solution for a problem. We should remain friendly with each other, and we should not use colored language in the communication with each other. I don't think that this is should be continued. This is the second time that I see such a colored language, and we need to abandon that and try to be objective and productive and positive. Thank you.
Thanks for your question and comment, Caboose. I don't know, Barry or someone, if you could put the list up into the Adobe Connect room rather than pasting it into the chat where it is kind of confusing. To answer your question, Caboose, so that methodology and membership selection criteria came from the earlier cross-community effort, I think, on IANA transition or accountability or, you know, it all kind of blends together for me, not for you guys who participated. But, you know, after spending, you know, money on legal advice in its second iteration for that team, this method for getting sound legal advice but doing it in an economically responsible way was developed. And part of that historically was to require the team members to be attorneys. So I'll tell you that I largely agree with your sentiment. And, in fact, you know, I don't know what the words on the slides were exactly, but I know what my words were orally, and that was that, you know, Rafiq and I had decided prior to the last meeting that we would modify the criteria somewhat and express a preference for having an attorney or someone with significant legal experience be on the team. And but if one of the groups, but we also thought every group should be represented if they wanted to be on this legal team. And so if there wasn't a licensed attorney or a lawyer on the in that group, then they could have someone join that team with the best possible experience. So I agree with you that all groups should be represented, and that legal experience or legal expertise or a legal certificate should be a very, very strong preference, but not an absolute requirement. So I hope that answers your question. So this is who's on the team so far, and we don't have anyone from the non-commercial group. Or who's the other group we don't have someone from? I have to look at my... someone from ESSAC. So
ESSAC.
We're looking for... Yeah, right. So we're... Thanks. So we're... Thanks, Alan. So we're... in an email we sent out, we had a couple requests for people that might be represented there. So anyway, so that's the agenda, and that's the the agenda for the meeting tomorrow, roughly put, and it'll be put out more detail shortly after this meeting. We've already had a discussion about it. We're just typing it up. And that's the membership. And if we get, you know, we've suggested in our email that went out, we've suggested members from both ESSAC and non-commercial stakeholder groups, so our constituencies. So if we could get those nominees, they'll certainly be included in the meeting. So that's all I have about that. Unless there are any other questions, we'll go on to the next agenda item, which I'd like to be about the comment period.
Language used in the communication between the team. Thank you.
Yep, I got it. Thank you very much, Caboose. So receiving comments and interacting with the community, the support team has noticed some repetition in the questions. So they undertook the initiative to put together this FAQ, which I guess is seeing the light of day for the first time right now, because it was worked on over the weekend. And so Caitlin, do you want to talk to this?
Yes, thank you, Kurt. This is Caitlin Schubergen for the transcript. And I wanted to thank everyone that has submitted questions about the Google form so far. And this document that you now see on your screen will be distributed with the notes from today, so that if you'd like to send the document to your constituency, that would be helpful. Or if you happen to have members from your constituency that are contacting you, you can refer them to this form. In short, I'll go through the questions quickly. Some of you probably already know the answers since we went through them during the webinar, and some of you had already asked these questions. But I did want to emphasize that the EPDP leadership team did choose the Google form, since it automatically sorts comments by questions, and it will expedite the process for reviewing any comments submitted by the community. Additionally, it will prevent human error of the EPDP support staff trying to guess what a commenter may be commenting on. If the comments are responded to with the specific question, we wouldn't have to guess where the comments are trying to, which section of the initial report the comments are in reference to. For anyone that is unable to submit the comments using the Google form, there is a Word version, which is linked to in this document. The Word version is also helpful if you'd like to collaborate or work offline with your answers. I believe Christina asked this question, and I send an answer to the list, but in case you didn't see it, you are not required to respond to every question in the Google form. In fact, if you only want to comment on one topic, such as the purposes for processing or the redaction of certain data elements, you're welcome to only respond to those questions. There are, however, a few questions that are noted with a red asterisk, and those questions must be responded to in order to continue within the form. And so those questions are email address, name, and affiliation. As I had noted previously, submitting your email address only allows Google to send your completed form back to you. However, your email address will not be published on the Google spreadsheet where the comments appear. All email addresses will be redacted. Another common question we get is, if you want to complete part of the form, will your answers be published to the Google spreadsheet? And the answer is yes. So if you are concerned with having certain responses appear publicly before your constituency or you've had a chance to review, what we would recommend is working offline on the Google form and then submitting all of your responses at once. Another issue that has come up is that if you choose to edit your responses, you may encounter a word limit for questions or for responses. The character limit does not apply when you're submitting answers for the first time. However, that is a glitch that we've encountered. The workaround would be you're welcome to email your completed Word document to the email address provided on this form, and the ePDP support staff will be happy to assist you. Also, if you happen to submit comments or a Google form in error, it will appear on the Google spreadsheet, the public Google spreadsheet, but if you would like it deleted, please also send a message to one of the support staff or the email address provided on this document, and we can manually delete that response if there's something you didn't mean to respond. I think that is all of the commonly asked questions, but we will submit, or we will send this document along with the notes from today so that everyone can have them on hand. Thank you. Back over to you, Kurt.
Dylan, what would be the process if, you know, these were questions harvested by us, so what would be the process for having additional questions and answers included on this form? Should the team members send them to you, or should the team members tell their groups who they're representing to send additional questions to that should be included in this form on a certain address, or will you just continue to monitor the questions you have and add them as we go along?
That's a good question. Thank you, Kurt. I'll paste the ePDP leadership email address down in the chat, and that would be a good place to send any other questions that are not addressed on this form. You're also welcome to email ePDP staff support directly, which is what's been happening so far. But if we can gather all questions in the same place, that would be preferred. So I think the best way of doing that is to use the ePDP leadership list.
Great. Thanks, Caitlin, and thanks for going to the trouble to do that. Caboose, do you have a question?
Yes, I apologize. First of all, you did not answer my comments regarding the behavior and ethics and friendly manner that the whole team are obliged and required to implement rather than attacking each other in one way or other. This is very, very important, and I don't think that we are member of the group to listen or to be subject to some sort of discolored language, and you need to give instruction or discipline to the people that people should not practice this sort of things. If we don't like a passage or if we don't like any comments from anybody, we just diplomatically and kindly and friendly say that we don't agree with you, but we do not insult them indirectly or directly. So this is something that you need to remind everybody. This is very, very important. Please kindly take that. I send you a small message before the meeting, and I hope you will take that into account. Now, I am not sure about the questions. What are these questions? What is the source of these questions? These questions sometimes may be misleading, may generate other questions or answers that we may not be able to reply. So we should have very clear idea what are these questions, who raised the question, and what is the nature of the question and the purpose of the question. So I'm sorry, I have not followed that. I maybe missed something, but I would like to have some small clarification what we are talking about. The question, additional questions, team questions, to whom this question is raised, and what is the purpose of this question? Thank you.
Well, these are quite, Caboose, these are questions that the support team has been fielding from those who are filling out the comment form. And where there's been repeat questions, the support team thought that others might have the same questions, and so undertook with some initiative, the publication of this brief frequently asked questions form. To the extent that the questions or answers are vague, maybe, but I just think communication is a good thing. So if these questions raise other questions, then so be it. But at least we're communicating, so I'm for that. And, Caboose, I apologize for not answering your comment. You know, You know, you said you had a question and a comment, so I answered your question and didn't think your comment needed an answer. I agree with your assessment that we should treat each other with mutual trust and respect. So I think this list might grow over the next several days. And so, Caitlin and the rest of the team, thanks for doing it. And let's, especially since the next couple of days are going to be critical to receiving comments, I think we want to make sure everybody has the link to this and that it might be updated from time to time. So thanks very much for that. Do you want to go over action items, or I just soon dive into the substantive part of the agenda?
Kurt, this is Caitlin for the transcript. I'll just note for the team that the action items for leadership, which was to send around draft language to capture the team's discussion on geographic differentiation, as well as the policy impact assessment, we'll be sending around language for the team to review this week.
Okay, great. Yeah, it's on my laptop, but I'm sorry I've been sending that. All right, so let's get into the agenda. And, you know, Kavu's comment and other emails have given rise to why these topics are on the agenda. And I'll just say that, you know, when we, the support staff, published the list of outstanding items after to be discussed after the publication of the initial report, we solicited additional issues from the whole team and provided a deadline and say, if you want to add these issues, any issues to the discussion, please provide it by this deadline. So these are the ones that are submitted. And in fact, it reflects language in the temporary specification where we haven't had a discussion on them yet. So I think discussion is merited. So without ado, let's dive into that. And I think Margie or anyone else, but I think Margie is probably the best one to introduce these topics. And the first one is about privacy proxy service and the language that's disclosed at a certain point. So, Margie, if you could provide some input. And I just want to call attention to the fact that Mary Wong is on the call from ICANN staff today, and she's leading the implementation on what's a PPSAI, which is the privacy proxy implementation standard privacy proxy implementation. I forget what it's called. So Mary's either here to ask questions or answer them. So I think that's helpful. And thanks a lot for attending, Mary. Margie, are you prepared to talk?
Sure. Sure. Thanks, Kurt and everybody. I think one of the reasons we raised this is as we took a look at the initial report, we noticed that we hadn't actually talked about the language and the temporary spec related to how the privacy proxy services are affected by the policy that we're going to develop. And so one of the things we want to make sure that we don't lose sight of is that the temporary spec has the language essentially that if there's a privacy proxy service, the registrar must return in response to a query the full Hulu's data, including the existing privacy proxy pseudonymized email. So that we just want to confirm that there's no issue with continuing with Section 2.6, which is in the Appendix A. So that's the first part of it, and I thought maybe we could talk about that first. And then we can go into more detail on what else might need to be addressed with respect to privacy proxy services. Is there any, Kurt, do you want me to continue, or do you want to talk about that first?
Okay, let's talk about that part. You know, I'm mostly focused on the language in the in the TEMPS backend, whether we agree with, you know, whether we want that language to remain or not.
Okay.
I see Alex has his hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. Good morning, everyone. This is Alex. Yeah, I think it makes sense to add something similar to the text in Section 2.6 of the TEMP spec as a recommendation. I remember before the TEMP spec was being discussed, you know, I was chatting to several registrars about this issue. If you think about kind of the practicality of doing this, I think it makes sense not only for people asking for data to be disclosed, but also for the registrar who has to actually do the disclosure and process disclosure under this reasonable access regime that the TEMP spec lays out. The idea it would be a much better use of time to simply put that privacy proxy data into the who is and to the public who is, and because if you don't, then what happens is that a disclosure, you know, the steps and the hoops that are required to jump through the disclosure request have to be done by the requester, and then the you know, the registrar has to do the analysis based on the request, and in the end, if what's returned is simply the privacy proxy data, I think, you know, it's time not well spent for both the registrar and the requester. So I thought this was a pragmatic recommendation in the TEMP spec to simply, you know, cut to the chase and provide that privacy proxy in the public who is versus having to essentially waste that time to get to a point where, oh, well, this is privacy proxy and then separate processes kick in. So I just wanted to kind of give some color to why I think this is a good idea. Thanks.
I'm go ahead, James. So my comment here will just demonstrate my total ignorance, but I'm reading the TEMP spec language and I don't understand quite what it's requiring. Registrar must return in response to any query full WHOIS data, including the existing privacy proxy anonymized email. I'm not sure exactly what that requirement is. Maybe James can explain that to me, and I'm sure you guys all understand it, but then respond to Alex and Margie. Go ahead, James. How are you today?
Good morning. Thanks, Kurt. I'm well, and I hope everybody's doing great. So my understanding is that this is essentially that to invert the requirement that privacy proxy WHOIS data should not be redacted or non-public, that if you're already using a privacy proxy service, that that should be part of a public response to any query. My question here is, and I recognize we're starting to collide a little bit with the PPSAI work that's currently on pause pending, you know, the outcome of this PDP, but setting that aside for a minute, my concern is that this all makes sense if the privacy proxy service is either a service offered by the registrar or somehow a separate organization affiliated with the registrar of record. Where it gets messy is, and I want to, you know, emphasize this for the group, is that privacy and proxy services can be separate service providers, and in some cases they could be independent registrar that's managing the domain name. So it's one of those situations where in the edge case where the registrant has engaged a privacy proxy service that is not affiliated with the registrar and is unknown to the registrar, then how would the registrar, you know, just by default be aware that a privacy proxy service is being used, you know, if they didn't recognize the information that was being provided? So I think that this all makes sense in the general case, but I think that we need to maybe tighten up the language a little bit to ensure that in those situations where a registrar is not aware that a privacy proxy service is being used, that they can't be held as non-compliant for redacting that data, you know, if that's not brought to their attention. Thanks.
Thanks for that, James. Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you very much. James basically said most of what I was going to say. The registrar can only do that if they know it's a privacy proxy provider. And I note that although it says registrar in the temporary spec, in the real world, for a thick registry, the registry is the, in theory, the authoritative source of information right now, and they don't know unless they happen to recognize the name until we get the PPSAI actually implemented. I will note, however, that if we were honoring legal persons' requirements to display all of their information, I would presume virtually all privacy proxy services are indeed legal persons and not natural persons. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Go ahead, Alex. Is that a new hand?
Yeah, new hand. This is Alex. So, yeah, so, James, I think we can definitely work on the wording. I think it still makes sense to solve for, I guess, the majority case instead of the edge case here. I mean, I understand, and, you know, I was part of the PPSAI PDP, so, you know, I've seen it and done it. But just because there's edge cases exist, I think it shouldn't mean that we not create a policy for again the majority case. I think it still helps both sides, if you will, the requesters and the registries and well the registrars in this case. Thank you.
Alex, go ahead, Margie.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to echo what Alex said. We can certainly come up with policy that addresses James's issue. And one of the things that, if you take a look at the way the RAA was drafted, it has rules on privacy proxy services. And if I'm not mistaken, it relates to affiliates, but we could as well. So we can come up with the cases so that if it's unknown that there is a privacy proxy service, that it wouldn't apply. And we could even, you know, create a list. I think at least with respect to privacy proxy services that relate to that somehow affiliated with registrars, you know, I could ask them, do you have any privacy proxy services? So at least there's some, you know, some central place where there's a list of the privacy proxy services, at least until the new policy is adopted.
Thanks, Margie. Go ahead, James.
Sure. Just a follow-up to Alex and Margie's intervention. Perhaps I was unclear that I was not advocating for removal of this requirement, but I was indicating that we need more specific language to capture that exception, because I've heard now a couple of folks saying that we shouldn't get rid of this. I agree, we shouldn't get rid of this. We need to tighten it up, and I think we can do that with perhaps just a qualifier that the privacy proxy service is affiliated with or known to the registrar, something along those lines. I hate drafting on the call, but I think you get where I'm going with this. That I think that we can fix this. I'm not trying to throw any babies out with the bathwater. I'm just trying to make sure that the drain isn't too wide. Thanks.
good metaphor. You know, I register domain names for my kids, so I don't know if that makes me a proxy service or not. I know we don't want to draft on the call, but I'm thinking that the idea that we say that in the case of a domain name registration with a domain name registration where an accredited registrar provided privacy proxy service, that's probably, I'm kind of checking with anybody here, that's probably not good enough, right? Because the way the rules around privacy and proxy services are written, it has to be a separate organization or something like that. So am I correct in thinking the language has to be a little more subtle than that? So I hope you can hear me. So I'm thinking my proposed language there is not sufficient. So what's the way home for modifying this language in a way that James is suggesting? There's Dan's language. Go ahead, James.
Kurt, I think some, James speaking, I think some version of Dan's language that he has there, it's blue for me. I don't know if it's blue for everybody else.
Yeah.
And then Margie added a phrase about, or known to the registrar, made available by registrar, made available by or known to the registrar or its affiliates. That probably fixes my concern. So I don't know if we're all aligned on that one and we can capture it and memorialize it and just kind of get moving on some of our other stuff, but I think that was just, that's the gist of it. Thanks.
Okay, great. Go ahead, Margie.
Sure. Okay, before we move on, I want to make sure we're clear on this one because I have additional issues to add related to privacy proxy services.
Okay. So Caitlin, if you could make those amendments to the language, and we can either put them up in the chat room here or in the Adobe Connect room here, or it's more appropriate, email later, and see if there's any comments to it. Either way, I think would be fine. And go ahead, Margie.
Okay, sure. Now the second issue is a little more complicated, and that's why I wanted to at least tee it up. So the concern we have is that the privacy proxy services implementation is installed because of the ePDP. And if we don't address that aspect, I think we're doing a disservice to ICANN and to the community. And what I'm thinking of is that I think collectively we've reached, you know, an understanding of how GDPR applies in the WHOIS world. And I think that we can give direction to the implementation with regard to the things that we've already sorted out. Like, for example, the purposes for WHOIS. It makes sense to me that for a privacy proxy service, if you're going to ask for a reveal, you need to list the purposes that would be consistent with the purposes we've already identified or, you know, as part of our policy. That's an example of the kind of input that I think the ePDP team could give to the implementation. So one of the things that I think we should think about is a group is and that's just, you know, thinking off the top of my head, that's one example of the kinds of things that we should try to identify and clarify. In my view, it's something that we would probably kick off after we've done the rest of our work, but I think if we just had a couple calls with the team about and think through the privacy proxy implementation rules and what should change because of GDPR, we would be able to make progress on moving that policy, because it is a big gap if we don't have rules that apply to how the privacy proxy services work, and I think we want a parallel approach based on what we come up with in this ePDP. So that's the bigger issue I wanted to flag.
Okay, so understanding, for example, that our conclusions to date and the initial report hasn't been put through any sort of consensus test, I could choose to rely on some of those conclusions with the understanding that they might change, but it might be more efficient for the multi-stakeholder model and all of us if they adopted some of these conclusions, even if there might be some breakage. So I certainly think that's a good idea. So Margie or anybody else, and maybe even Mary Wong, so would the initial report kind of stand on its own in providing this sort of guidance, or Margie or others, what sort of interaction do you see in addition to that would be helpful for your cause?
If I could answer that, I think initial report's still too early. I'm thinking, you know, I mean, what's our timeline for final report? You know, basically, if we had a recommendation that, you know, and this recommendation could be that the group, you know, continues after the initial report to provide guidance to the implementation team or any subset of the team that's interested. And then, because I think the for example, like the purposes will be much more clear once we finish the public comment period and we, you know, and we come up with the final report. And so that's what I'm thinking. I think it's staged a little bit later, but not, you know, not so much that the implementation gets further delayed for years, because I think that would be a big problem.
Go ahead, Alex.
It's Alex. Yeah, so I think it's important to, I wanted to just read from the note that the letter that Cyrus has recently sent to the IPC about the delay of the PPIRT. And you know, one thing he says in that letter, which I think is important, he says nonetheless, ICANN.org believes that the work of the EPDP will address topics that are central to privacy proxy accreditation programs requirements, including, and he says, purposes for processing registration data such as collection, retention, transfer, allocation of controller process obligations for GTLD registration data. And so it seems like there is an assumption that this team do some work here. It's not exactly clear to me which work we need to do, either way, we need to make sure that there's not a disconnect between what ICANN.org is expecting us to do and what we actually end up doing. It may be that the work that we've done so far and will do in the future will address most of these issues, but we should, I think, as Margie suggests, at some point spend some time thinking about this to make sure there aren't any gaps. Thanks.
So does anybody see this as controversial? And Margie, how would you memorialize this in our work? Go ahead, Mark.
Thanks, Kurt. Mark Anderson. I did not join Privacy Proxy, and I'm not interested in doing their work. If their work requires, something from us, then that's fine. But, you know, Margie's example, if I understand it correctly, she talked about us defining purposes the purposes or reason, you know, the data that should be shared for reveal of privacy and proxy, and that to me, I think I think that's not our work. That's the privacy proxy's privacy proxy working group's job. So I think there's a little bit of a line here I'm trying to draw. You know, certainly if the work they need to do is dependent or held up on something we need to do, then let's make sure we're doing that. But I want to draw a line at making sure we're not doing their work, and so that's sort of the line I'm trying to draw there.
Thanks. Good comment. So I think I'm reading Amr's comment too. So I don't know. I hope everybody's in my boat. Thinking that the task lacks some specificity, although we're open to it, and we certainly want to address the GDPR related questions that this PPSAI group has. So I wonder, I don't want to stick Mary with a question, but I wonder how we. I'm not familiar with the work of that group, so I have trouble picking out certain aspects of a work that would be helpful to them or wouldn't be helpful to them and can't picture it. So Margie and anybody, to the extent you want to understand those questions, I think it's really good. And Mary, to the extent that you or ICANN or that working group or implementation group or whatever it is ask questions with specificity or point to issues with specificity where they're waiting for some resolution, I think that would be really helpful. But anyway, I think that's – go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead, Margie.
Sorry, I have to go offline. I'll still be on the call. What if we had a recommendation that ICANN apply the, you know, similar rules to those that are, you know, decided by the CCDP? In other words, you know, that they take the guidance that, or the direction that comes out of the ECDP as the basis for further developing the implementation plan for privacy proxy services.
So I think, you know, I don't want to spend too much more time on this one, and I think that's fine with me, but I think you have a concern that I don't understand. So you're doing this to head something off.
Yeah.
Or prevent
yeah.
something or cause something to happen, but I don't quite understand your underlying concern.
Sure, if I could address that. Because the PPSAI is stalled right now and because they don't have the expertise that's been, you know, in the area of GDPR applications, that they just don't have the support to take that policy implementation to, you know, to finally get it launched. And so I think they would benefit from the collective knowledge that's come out of this team, and that's why I'm raising it now. It's as something that could help direct the conclusion of that work.
Okay. Alan, go ahead. And then Mark.
Thank you, Kurt. Alan Wolf for the record there. I'm afraid I'm going to be universally rebuttaled after what I have to say, so apologies to everybody in advance. But let's also remember that, again, when we look at the definition of what personal data is, it is data that is capable of identifying a person either on its own or in connection with something else. And one of the big changes under GDPR is that other source of data does not necessarily need to be available to a person. It just means that if it is put with something else, it is capable of identifying that person. So PPSAI or privacy and proxy situations, in some of them, it's just, you know, privacy protected at privacy proxy. There's another one. I mean, I deal with them day in, day out. You've got privacy customer 12715 at is personal data. And also the email address is also privacy 12715 at. That is also private data. And even if a person is identified by the actual SLD that they have or the domain that they have. So again, you know, compliance ninja at privacy or proxy dot whatever. Again, it's technically, it's a hashed, it's an anonymized email. It's still private data or, personal data. So again, you know, this is another layer that we can put into it. Yes, it would be of a less heinous breach if it was to be put out there, but again, this is something we need to consider. It needs to go on the record, and we need to be really clear that this is not as simple as a wording change. This is, again, another type of privacy data protection impact assessment where we have to assess what is the data we're dealing with here, and, you know, we're still dealing with what is considered personal data under the definition. So, again, I just caution people to make that leap without, you know, really thinking about the quality of the data that we're working with. Sorry, all.
Well, thank you, Alan. Go ahead, Mark.
Thanks, Kurt. Mark Anderson again. You know, Matt Serling put in chat, you know, that it seems like, you know, he said, I'm not sure we specifically need to address anything we otherwise wouldn't. And I think that sort of gets the I think that's a good way of putting it. I'm not sure that privacy proxy needs anything from us that we weren't otherwise, you know, isn't otherwise already in our scope. And so, you know, I think we need to avoid doing their job. We don't need to make recommendations related to privacy proxy. It's not in our scope or charter, and there's already a group devoted to doing that. And we should also avoid trying to tell them how to do their job. They can take our work and pull what's applicable to them and leverage our work as they need to. But we should avoid doing their job or telling them how to do their job. And if they need something specific from us, I think it's on them to ask that of us, and not for us to decide what they need or want.
Thanks, Mark. Go ahead, Alex. And then Alan, and then let's go on to something else. I think we're to a point in this discussion where, you know, maybe I and some others can work together on. I think what Margie's after is getting the work of the privacy proxy group restarted as quickly as possible, and make sure we're not standing in the way. And so we want to figure out a way to make sure that our work is done in a way that doesn't hold them up. But, you know, I agree strongly with Mark's guideline. So I don't know how much more we can take on this. But if anybody has anything specific that they'd want to include in a proposal, that's good. Otherwise, I think we'll take this as an aspirational goal that we'll continue to hone as we go through the rest of our process. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, and this is Alex, I just wanted to say that I agree with Mark, but let's just make sure, and I'm glad that Mary's on the call here, because I just want to make sure that we're not making assumptions here, and that the path that we're currently on, the discussions that we're currently having, and the result that we all hope to get to will actually address the issues that the PPIRT need to commence their work. And I think, again, given Mary's involvement here and her listening to this discussion, and the letter that we received from Cyrus, I think we should be able to ensure that we don't end up in a spot where we don't actually fulfill or answer the questions that they may have, and that would put us in a bad spot. So thanks.
Thanks. Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you very much. I know I'm committing the sin of being pragmatic, but like Alex, and I feel that if we can provide any guidance, or if we can tell them where we're heading, or if they can ask questions to us and we actually answer them to expedite the whole thing without diverting us for weeks and weeks, then I think we have an obligation to do that. We may make decisions which will make certain things impossible for them, and there needs to be some communication path between the two. They are not separated in terms of what we can do. And although it's not part of our job to do their work, I think we have to make sure that we're not being obstreperous and getting in their way of allowing that work to be done at the same time. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Farzi. Farzanae.
Hi, Farzanae Radhi speaking. So I just wanted to make a very general point to the group. We need to discuss and agree on what topics are going to be on the agenda for the meetings and be topics of discussion, because obviously privacy proxy is something that a certain, probably minority, wanted to be added to the agenda, and we did not, as a group, we did not decide that this is within our remit. So we have been spending around 30 minutes discussing something, whether it is within scope or not. If you want to do that, then I can just like come up with like various agenda items and just like send them off to you, and to be discussed during our meeting. This is not really the way to go. I really believe that when we can't just add an agenda item because someone asked for it. Thank you.
Caboose.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I think I put in the chat that we should not discuss the issue based on minority or majority. We should discuss the issue based on the merit of the issue. We are not making a polarization or division or voting that majority or minority, so we should be quite careful. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Caboose. So, I'll just say that, you know, we asked for additional topics when we published the list of outstanding items after the initial report, and certainly the language that we discussed in the first part of the meeting was on here, and you know, I don't think it was out of bounds to discuss how we might interact with this PPSAI team. And we spent a few minutes on that. You know, we try to manage the things as best we can. So, Margie, with your permission, I'm going to leave this one behind. But let's, you know, I'm happy to discuss it over email and see how we could create the right space for this, you know, using the balancing that both Mark and Alan Greenberg mentioned. So if you're still with us, Margie, the next topic has to do with consent. Do you mind introducing
sure.
that?
Yeah, sure, and I'm still on. When I catch my bus, I might drop as I go over the mountain, so I might have to have one of my colleagues continue. So the next issue is the issue that we discussed, I believe, on email, and it relates to allowing for the registrant to consent to having their data published. I think this is important, not just from the legal NAFTA person distinction, but also I think there are probably registrants of all types that would like to have their information actually published. So one of the things that we've been talking about is having a recommendation that the registrant be offered the ability to consent to having their WHOIS information public, should they choose.
Right, and this goes to, you know, where the temporary specification says as soon as commercially reasonable, the registrar must provide the opportunity for the registered name holder to provide its consent to publish additional contact information. That's additional contact information, not its information. So are you expanding on that one, Margie?
The recommendations have two aspects. One is the registrant itself having its information published, and then the one we'll talk about after that is whether there needs to be the ability to get consent for a registrant to have someone else be their technical content. And so that's the second part of the analysis, but a second discussion we can talk about later.
Thanks, Margie. Go ahead, Brian. You want to pick up on this?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Excellent. So I can give a little color to that, especially if we lose Margie in the mountains there. The concept here is that we think it's important that registrars must allow this option, must allow registrants to make this decision. And I think we're skeptical of the proposition that registrars will allow this and will reflect the choices and the decisions that the registrant makes about having the data published. Most registrars are good guys and will do what the registrants want, but if they're not required to, we think it's a better system if registrars are required to provide that option and then to honor the registrant's choice.
Woods, go ahead.
Thank you, Alan, for the record. A very simple question to ask our colleagues there, and that is how? So it's all very well and good making a must there, but, you know, you're going into several layers of logging consent, removal of consent, Article 17, withdrawals of consent, right to be forgotten. You know, there's a lot more to this here. And again, I just keep bringing it back to this point. This is not our job. Our job is to say, is the temporary specification as is written or with modification as is necessary good enough to allow the contracted parties and ICANN to be compliant with the GDPR, and creation of a new system to somehow figure out how we can get consent is not going to be a must. But again, the concession there is that we can use our secondary power as an EPD team to say, let's punt that to the GNSO saying, this is something we really probably need to look into. So can we create a PDP which will be able to put bones on the suggestion that we have? But creating a consensus policy now that says we must do that is, again, creating an implementation impossibility at the moment, because it's not going to happen before the expiration of this this process. So, you know, just saying that a registrant is able to consent and they must be allowed to consent is actually just the poppycock. It's just ridiculous at this particular moment in time, and we need to face realities and facts on this. It is a good point, but let's put it where it should be, and that's the recommendation of the GNSO and nothing more.
Thanks, Alan. Alma, go ahead.
Thanks, Kurt. This is Amar. Not going to argue with Alan's point on the scope of what we need to do here, but I wanted to offer a different sort of thought on this. I think for many reasons, you know, voiced in the past, the issue of consent is a little tricky. It's trickier than I believe we should want to, you know, to deal with it as an issue. As an alternative, I would propose that instead of a registered name holder, you know, having the option of providing consent, you know, I'm sure we're not, at this point, we're not all talking about ticking a checkbox. But as an alternative, if there could be a process where a registered name holder could actively request for their data to be published, then that might be a more viable alternative. And that would take us away from Article 8 and the issues of consent and move us towards 6.1b, which is, you know, the performance of a contract, among other things, including, you know, at the request of the data subject. So generally, the default would be redaction, and anything additional to that is an additional service provided by registrars that if a name holder or a data subject wishes for the data to be published, then there are additional steps that need to be taken. I'm wondering what folks might think about something like that. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that, Amar. Alan Greenberg?
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a response to Amir. If the registrar can handle that, what he's proposing, that is, offer an extra service to allow giving permission and perhaps charge for the permission of displaying their WHOIS data, then they can handle the getting consent. It's the same. It ends up being the exactly same issue, and I'm. My mind is just boggling at the fact that the whole concept of consent and some of the other issues we're discussing related to the GDPR are deemed to be so difficult for the contracted parties, yet other people around the world are implementing them. It's just really difficult. Going forward, I think we need to be able to do this. We do not necessarily need to come to a conclusion on this by the end of May 2019, but we've already acknowledged there's lots of other stuff that we're working on that has to be done before we finish. And saying the concept of asking the GNSO to start a new PDP on the stuff that we're not going to do is pushing it so far down the road as to make it not viable at all. Thank you.
Sarah, welcome to the team.
Hi.
So,
yeah, do you hear me?
So for those of you that don't know, you know, Sarah's on recently joined the team, and I know from personal experience that registrars, registries, the IPC, the BC, they all have big teams supporting the effort that the representatives here have. So just because Sarah's new to the team doesn't mean she's new to the issues or new to our discussion. So anyway, go ahead, please.
That's true, and thank you so much for the welcome, Kurt. I have been following the EPVP throughout your work, and it's really exciting to be able to help as an alternate. So I just want to say a couple things from this registrar perspective about this idea of consent to publication. Amar, I noticed you mentioned in the chat that perhaps contract might be an appropriate legal basis for this. I think in this case, because it's not necessary to perform the registration contract, we can't rely on the contract to publish the information. I do think it would be consent-based, and I would be okay with that. I think we can accept that the person requesting it, there are mechanisms in place to get the consent of the registrant, but I think it should be optional on both the registrant's part but also the registrar to even offer that service. I'm not sure that we need to make it a must. I think it should be a may. And yeah, the consent legal basis. Thank you.
Sarah, go ahead, Stephanie. Hey, we can't hear you.
Terry, I see your mic is unmuted. Could you check on your side? And now it seems your mic is muted again. Oh, yep, we sure can. Please continue.
Always takes a trial run.
Sure. Stephanie Perrin, for the record, echoing what Tara just said, this should not be mandatory. It could be voluntary, but I would just like to issue a word of caution that getting consent to publish sensitive data is not that easy. And Alan Greenberg just said that, you know, companies around the world are doing it. They're not necessarily doing it well, and they're certainly not necessarily publishing data on the basis of consent. That's a whole other ballgame. People don't understand the risk, don't understand the global cheer of putting out their cell phone. They're not expecting to get calls from around the world. So I really think we should leave this up to registrars. It doesn't need to form part of the policy if it's voluntary. Thank you.
And Kurt,
I was on mute. So, yep. So, go ahead. Thanks for that, Stephanie. Go ahead, Brian.
A couple points that I think might help clarify. So, we are we think that it should be required. So, we think it should be a must. The registrars must make the option available to registrants. And if they don't, if it's not mandatory for registrars to do it, then many won't. And there's a lot of registrants that aren't savvy enough to know that they could shop for a registrar that might allow them to publish more information, especially if they're a domain investor or someone who wants to be contacted about their domain name or what's happening on their website. So that's important. And I think that making it a must also helps protect the registrants who have made that election to publish more data or want to make that election in the future. But then the registrar has no reason to do that if they don't have to. And the other concept I would just make everyone aware of is that this isn't really a new concept. So registrars have, as far back as I can remember, been required to tell registrants which data is required that the registrant provide and which data is voluntary. And that's in the temp spec, and that's in the 2013 RIA. And so this isn't a new concept. We just want this to remain a must that registrars have to continue to make that that option available to the registrant, and then to reflect and respect the registrant's choice.
But Curtis, Margie, if I can be in the queue.
Sure, go ahead, Margie.
Sure, and to follow up on what Brian said, the other thing you have to think about is the registries. How will the registries know there needs to be some sort of ability to tell the registries that there is consent to publish the data. So that's why I think it makes more sense to make it a must rather than a may, since the registries will have to have that type of information available to be able to publish the data.
Amar, please go ahead.
Thomas, just John, can I get in the queue, please?
Yeah, you'll go right after Amar, and you'll speak right after Amar speaks. And thanks very much for joining, Thomas. Go ahead, Amar.
It's Curtis Amar again. just to repeat some of what I said in the chat and some of the other issues that I'm seeing, on may versus must, I agree with Matt. I think, you know, if a name holder knows enough about registration data and how it works and whether it's published or redacted, I think it's fairly obvious that they would know that, you know, what it is they want, which choice they might seek in that scenario. And if their chosen registrar does not provide this service, then they're free to go ahead and shop for another one that does. As an issue of awareness, I don't envision it being much of a problem. But the other point I wanted to make on 6.1b, because I referenced that article earlier, you know, performance of the contract is just part of that article on lawfulness of processing. The other part, which follows the or in the article, is in order to take steps at the request of the data subject prior to entering into a contract. So if a scenario or if a processing activity meets that criteria as a lawful basis for processing the data, I think it might work, and to me it seems a lot more straightforward than you know, trying to meddle with the issue of consent and requirements in Article 8. Thank you.
Greenberg.
Sorry, if I could follow up on that real quick. This is Amar again.
Go on.
The distinction in the process here would be that, you know, like Colin said earlier, it's privacy by design. So the redaction would be the default setting. And anything beyond that would be an additional service that a registrar chooses to provide. And the registered name holder would have to actively seek this service, you know, one way or another. So I think this handles the issue of, you know, name holders who wish for their data to be published. They have an avenue to go ahead and do that. On the other hand, I believe it also provides adequate protection from liability to contracted parties and other controllers involved in the processing activity. Thank you.
Well, Amar, wouldn't consent be sort of a, you know, a paid-for service also? Alan Greenberg, and trying to make the distinction that you're drawing. I understand how it falls under a different category, but in fact, it would kind of operate the same, right? That a registrant could either provide, you know, check the box and say, Please publish my information I consent to, or, you know, please publish my information in accordance with the registrant agreement we have that I can request this additional service. To me, they're both services provided by the registrar, are they not?
This is Amar, Kurt. I think the difference would be that in a scenario where consent is granted, that, you know, the consent may be included within a consent form that covers other topics. And this is where it gets a little tricky, I think. And in Article 8, I think that you know, Article 8 covers this somewhat and says that, you know, it has to be very clearly distinguishable, but, you know, the extent to which it is distinguishable could be subjective depending on the data subjects you're dealing with, and a number of issues could come up. But in the other scenario, which where 6.1b would be the legal basis here, the name holder or the data subject would have to actively seek the service and sign up for it. So this is an additional service provided for name holders who specifically want this service. It's not a default service included in a consent form, amongst other things, which most, if not all, name holders probably don't go over in too much detail.
Thanks. Alan, I'm going to let I already asked Thomas to speak, so I'm going to let him cut in front of you if you don't mind. So, Thomas Rickard, please go ahead.
Thanks very much, Kurt, and hi, everyone. Sorry for joining late. I think that James is perfectly right, who said a couple of days back that there is a need from part of his customers to have their data publicized. So I think there is a need for that service for certain registered name holders. At the same time, I think we need to be quite honest about the technical limitations that we might face at this stage. So either if we go for a consent-based solution, or if we try to define a different service that would make the publication sort of a service paid or unpaid to have registered name holders data publicized in a global directory service, I think we don't have the technical means to document what's required to be documented under GDPR. We've been discussing this on a couple of occasions, but if you're doing consent-based processing, you need to be able to evidence that consent and what the content of that consent is all the way through. And those who are seeking consent-based solutions may be able to help with this, but I don't see any way in the registration data and the way it is passed on between the plethora of parties involved to allow for exactly that demonstration. So I think that whilst there is a legitimate call for such functionality to be implemented, I would like to support what Alan Wood said a couple of minutes back, namely that this is a more cumbersome exercise than we might think, and I think it's too much on our plate for the limited time that we have in this EPDP. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. Go ahead, Alan.
I was asked in the chat to point out that Stephanie has been at the top of the queue for a while.
Oh, I thought that was an old hand. Stephanie, is that a new hand?
She's muted, though.
I see. Alan, why don't you go ahead, and we'll see if...
All right. For everyone on these calls, registering a domain name may seem like a real simple thing, and the concept of shopping around to see who has what feature may sound simple. For the typical registrant, it's not. It's a confusing world that they don't understand the rules, the number of complaints that contractual compliance gets simply because people don't understand issues. Not because it's a real problem, is just unbelievable. And I don't think we can add something like this. Now, if we want to add a requirement that every registrar must clearly on their home page say which services they have chosen to offer and which services they do not offer, maybe that would be fine. But I don't think they're going to be willing to do that. So there's just no way we can say, oh, well, shop around for a feature you don't even know exists. Thank you.
Thanks. Stephanie, are you in the queue? Is that a yes, you're in the queue?
Hi, can I call you back? I'm on a call. Hi. Hello? Stephanie?
Oh, Stephanie.
Hi. Sorry about that.
I raised my hand. I basically agree with what Thomas Rickert said. I think you're going to need the equivalent of the Apple agreement that we all click and say, I agree, even though we haven't read, in order to cover consent. And the trouble is, you're then going to be stuck with dealing with withdrawal of consent issues and all the rest of it. So I think we should absolutely park this one. It's too hard when you're talking about individuals that are entitled to protection under the GDPR. If you are talking about large corporations who are find it easy to decide and prove that they are legal persons, I've suggested a number of times that we ought to be thinking in terms of their requirements and needs of how we could authenticate them based on something like corporation number, business registration numbers in each country, and allow them to authenticate themselves and provide tokens for registration of domain names in their name. That would go a long way to solving some trademark and identity theft issues. Those are real security concerns. I just want to throw that on the table. It is not for this group to figure this out because we don't have time.
I don't think it's for this group to figure out either, but we should be saying in our policy what needs to be figured out and to what extent. So I don't think it's within our bailiwick to solve this problem. I think it's within our bailiwick to set the goals for the implementation now and at a later date. Alan, go ahead. Alan Woods.
Thank you. Thank you. It's Alan Woods for the record. So I just wanted to just go back on one thing that Amit had done. I just want to be just go on the record as well, because I said in the chat, I just want to be clear that 6.1b, it could be just a disagreement in the reading of the actual article itself, but, you know, the at the request of the data subject prior to entering into a contract are those things that if, in order to enter into a contract, the data subject must request of the data controller to process their data, to contact them, to discuss with them, that it's kind of a stopgap measure. If you're relying only on a contract, you must be able to somehow process data before entering into that contract, and that's what that's getting at. Not that the data subjects themselves can request an additional matter that you must do. I mean, I just think that there was in my mind, it's a different reading of it, but I would suggest it's probably a mistaken reading of it. Sorry, Amber. And just as I was saying there, this I think Ashley and Brian are saying in the chat there about this whole gun shy when it comes to GDPR. And again, it makes me laugh, because being gun shy to the GDPR, yeah, let's put that by what it actually means, not as being risk adverse and trying to follow the law and make sure that, you know, it is up to an individual company to control their risk in the way that they see fit. And again, it's not our place in the consensus policy to force a registry or a registrar into a position where they're forced to take a higher risk because it suits other people. At the end of the day, we must be the masters of our own destiny in this, and if it is compliant with the law, we should be able to act compliant with the law, not be forced in a position which we maintain puts us in a less compliance with the law. But again, you know, gun shy when it comes to GDPR is unnecessarily inflammatory when you put it that way. It's just a matter of whether or not certain businesses are in a position to take on that risk. And we need to be mindful of that we're catering to the entire spectrum of the contracted parties, as sounds like I'm here, and not just big players that could just take that on the chin.
So when I read, so I'll get back to the queue in a second. So let me pose this that I hope is received constructively. But when I think about these things, I think about implementation details and their practicality. And I note that the temp spec uses the word must, but it also uses the word when commercially feasible. And an alternate wording might be to take out when commercially feasible, but add the word may. And the reason I say these is that, requiring registrars or registries to offer services such as accepting consent or, you know, in Amr's alternate proposed publication service. There's several ways, if required, that can be implemented. So at a very base level, a registrar could charge a lot of money for it and effectively make it not offered, or a registrar could put it in a place on its web page where it's not really findable or it's difficult to find, or create a process that's so onerous that it's really difficult to take advantage of. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's a sort of a little chess game. So for each one of these things I mentioned, I'm sure many of you said, well, then we can create this requirement to make sure it's done this way. But it's a continual chess match that's, I've never applied it to thought about it with consent before, but I've sure thought about it with regard to many other aspects of the, you know, the new GTLD program and registry and registrar agreements and those sorts of things. So I'm wondering if, you know, we're by using the word must, we're creating something that's really, really almost an impossible land to administrate if a registry or registrar doesn't want to offer that. And I wonder if we should recognize that impracticability when considering what wording to use in this. And that some, and I think many, and many of the largest registrars will want to be able to provide for consent or the publication of data when their customers want that. But for other ones that find it problematic, at least in the initial phases of this GDPR enforcement, where everybody's trying to understand how it'll be enforced, I think it's difficult. So that's my speech about pragmatism that might be controversial. But go ahead, Brian. Start back with the cue.
Sure. Thanks, Kurt. And James and Alan, I hope you guys, and Sarah, I hope you understand that we're not trying to add risk to one party for the benefit of ourselves or other parties. So just wanted to make that clear. And with that said, I think that we're not talking about a situation here that requires any kind of development or implementation costs or anything like that. I'm not even sure where that concept comes from, because, as I mentioned before, providing registrants with a clear explanation of which data is voluntary to provide, that they're allowed to provide, to be contacted, and which is mandatory, has always been the law of the land. And what we want is just for that to continue. And I think it's really important under GDPR to be clear with registrants about what data they can provide. And this is really to kind of reframe the concept here. I think that we all agree that we need to contact registrants or to have the ability to contact registrants. And what we're really asking here is that registrars are required to tell the registrants about all the options at their disposal for that, and whether that's having data published and which data they want published. That's really what we're asking for here, to kind of frame it that way.
Thanks, Brian. Ashley, how are you? Go ahead.
Thank you. This is Ashley with the GAC. So first of all, just to apologize if my use of being gun-shy was taken in an offensive way. That certainly wasn't my intention. It was more of the trying to get to the point that there seems to be this assumption that everyone is still is working at the same level of knowledge, and that everyone understands how this business works and what is available to them and what is a viable thing to achieve. And that goes on both the assertions of that potential registrants out there understand what is available to them in terms of offerings, as well as assuming that all the registrars out there are as informed as you all on this EPDP and understand what they can and can't do under GDPR and what is, you know, feasible to do in the construct of their WHOIS requirements and being compliant with GDPR. So it was more of I was actually making a comment in the spirit of compromise, saying that perhaps we could consider, you know, if it's not going to be a must, then at least have it reflected in the in our report and recommendations that this is something a registrar could do, and that they could do it in a way that is compliant with GDPR if they so choose to do so. because it's not clear to me that all the registrars out there and are contracted by ICANN understand that it's even something that they could do for all the reasons that we've articulated, particularly in the chat. So that's all I was trying to get at, and I realize that there's a lot of sensitivities around there. It wasn't intended as a dig. It was more of a just recognize that a lot of people are sensitive about this issue and are definitely risk averse, but there are some areas that we can take that aversion away if possible, and I think this could be one of them. Thanks.
Thanks, Ashley. Go ahead, James.
Sure, James speaking. So I think a couple of folks referenced a message I posted to the list, a while back, that we are hearing from some significant segment, I wouldn't say a majority, but let's say a noticeable minority of our customer base that has asked us for this function, for, you know, can I give you consent? Can I be published in WHOIS? Can you cancel the redaction even though legally I'm entitled to have my personal data protected? And I will note that one thing that they all have in common is that they are making this request because it somehow benefits them. They're not making this request so that they can be more easily contacted by third parties. They are, for legal and abuse issues. They are doing it as a form of advertising or marketing, particularly for those who invest in name names as a business. So I think I'm kind of now coming down to the idea that this is a service because it benefits the registrant where applicable, and they're not necessarily providing this consent for the benefit of other stakeholders, except it's primarily for them. And so that's why I believe ultimately it should be optional, because it is a kind of an add-on or a value-added service that a registrar can provide. But I agree with Ashley. I think that there's a way to capture this in such a way that registrars are not compelled to offer this function, particularly those, you know, I think a general market registrar like my employer would probably choose to offer it, and so would a number of other large registrars. But there are plenty of small registrars that serve a specific market or a specific type of client, or even maybe a single client, that this would not be applicable to and would just add cost and complexity. So I agree, and I think that I can kind of get behind Ashley's proposal that we kind of, you know, make this a disclosure requirement but not a requirement to carry. So thanks.
Thanks, James. Go ahead, Margie.
Sure, you might lose me because I'm going up the mountain. I think if it's a name on the registrar side, I think it needs to be a must on the registry side, because otherwise it may not be effectuated. In other words, the registrant may expect that the registry would be publishing it, and there's no way to basically guarantee that. So I think that we might have to think about it the same way that we thought about the technical contact, where the technical contact was optional to the registrant, but the registries had to publish it if the registrant asked for it. So I think that part of it needs to be treated the same way as we treated the technical contact.
Thanks for that point, Margie. Benedict, how you doing?
Hey, folks. One of the complaints of registrars, sort of privately and publicly, has often been that that ICANN heaps regulation on the heads of the good guys, and in order to regulate the bad guys who never show up to this kind of meeting and who don't comply with policy much anyway. So whilst I'm okay with May, particularly in an environment where everybody's sort of honest, in a situation like where we have got some registrars that don't comply, I'm just worried that this may allow bad registrars, of which a few exist, to give another layer of obfuscation to their bad customers, because there's a kind of collusion between the two. So I'm tending towards must, but I'd love to hear arguments against. Thank you.
We're kind of toward the end of all the arguments, but thanks for your comment, Benedict. Mark, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kurt. It's Mark Anderson. Just responding to Margie's comment, Transferring of consent from a registrar to a registry raises a whole host of other issues. I think if we're talking about a may for a registrar to publish this, then that's one set of challenges. And if registrars are willing to sign up for that, that's great. But putting an obligation for a registrar to obtain consent and pass that consent from a registrar to a registry and obligating the registry to publish that data, that opens up a whole another can of worms that I'm not at all comfortable with or willing to sign up for. As envisioned by the temporary spec, I think this would be an obligation for registrars to publish that in their service. But talking about passing consent from the registrar to the registry, I don't think that's what this is intended, and I don't think that's necessary for this to be accomplished. So I would not be comfortable or okay with putting that as a must on registries.
Thanks, Mark. So actually, I apologize for doing this, but in your discourse, you alluded to alternate language, and I've been sitting here trying to, divine what that might be. Do you have any ideas about that? And while you think about that, I'll call on Alan.
I guess it's a question for Mark. We have several 1,200, 1,400 registries that are thick registries, and the registry is the definitive authoritative source of who is information. If the consent is not transferred to the registry, aren't we defeating the purpose?
Sorry, Alan. This is Mark. I'm not sure I agree with you that the registry is definitive. I don't think that's the case in all situations. But I'm also not sure exactly what you're asking. I think my point is that we've been talking about a service that registrars may offer, and that makes sense. But they can offer that independent of the registry, and I don't see, I don't see why transfer to the registry needs to happen in order to accomplish this this service.
Kurt, may I answer?
Sure.
If you look, for instance, at the ICANN Whois portal for thick registries, they don't go to the registrar; they go to the registry because the registry is considered the source. So, saying you can disclose it, but the main source of information that is provided does not show it, I think defeats the purpose.
Why do we think the language in the temp spec just goes to registrars? It does not mention registries. Was anybody in on that discussion?
Only ICANN org can answer that question.
And does this become moot when RDAP's deployed?
Kurt, under the current registry agreements for everything but ComNet and jobs, the information must be transferred to the registry, and ICANN has always taken the position that the registry is the authoritative source in those cases. But
Alan, go ahead.
That's ICANN.
The other Alan. Thanks, Alan. Thank you, Alan Greenberg, and please go ahead, Alan Wood.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the transfer is there, and the registry should be an authoritative source of registrant information, but that doesn't mean that we have to publish it like you're asking. So I don't understand why the registry would be required to publish it. And you're saying that it just defeats the purpose. what purposes of the defeat? Because it is what you're saying here is that, you know, a registrar may publish it if it is required and they offer that service. I mean, they, you know, I try to think in my mind, what are the reasons that a registrant would want that published? So things such as there might be a company law requirement that they want to prove the ownership of a specific domain. So that registrant would then know that their registrar has published that because that was their choice and they found that and they used that specifically so they can get that public record. They don't need to go to them to the registry and say, just in case it doesn't agree with the registrar. So that one publication is what you're looking at. So I'm sorry, I don't get your point at all and I don't agree.
Is the problem that the registry can obtain the consent of the Does the registry need to obtain the consent of the registrant in order to publish the information, or is that taken care of when the registrar obtains the consent? I see that as a complexity, and maybe that's why the temp spec is written the way it is.
I just jump in there again, Solomon Woods again. I mean, that is one of the reasons that would be very difficult because, again, you're not getting consent from the registrar. Directly. So that's one of the issues, but there are multiple steps we've gone through, and Thomas has mentioned as well. But yeah, absolutely.
Ashley, go ahead, please.
So I'm just going to raise a question that Georgios had put in the chat, and you know, we're not on the front lines like registrars are. But it's not immediately clear why offering the option of providing or publishing their details and getting their consent why that is so difficult and why there's so much concern over risk associated with that. Happy to be educated, and I'm first to admit that I don't know what is involved with that, but it's from, you know, somebody looking in from the outside, it sounds fairly straightforward, which I know is a scary assumption to be making. That being said, I'm also not comfortable with people making assertions that the only reason why a registrant would want to publish this is to, you know, self-promote, et cetera, because I think it's way too soon to be kind of making those assertions. I think there's lots of reasons in which a registrant would want to have this information published, and I think those reasons could change over time. And I also think that this could be something, you know, potentially very much in the interest of registrars to make this optionally available. I think there's a lot of commercial interest if this should ever, you know, come to be a situation where it's a pay for service. So again, I'm still squarely in the must camp, which is why I'm a bit nervous about making any proposed language changes. I just wanted to throw out the idea of it being a may situation only because I would hate to see us come to the end of this conversation and have no recommendation. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks. Go ahead, Sarah.
Thank you. This is Sarah. To address the question of risks, I think the way I'm looking at it, the risk is of getting it wrong. And that's a very high risk because we don't want to publish personal data without there being an appropriate legal basis for doing so. So I do think that consent can be used as an appropriate legal basis, but I think we have to be very careful that we're getting consent from the right party, that we're recording it, that we're tracking it, and that we make it optional to withdraw that consent just as easily as it's given. So the risk just comes back to getting it wrong. And then the other point I wanted to make is regarding the difference or possible difference in who is outputs between registry and registrar who is outputs, depending on if the registrant consented. I don't really see why that's such a problem. I could imagine a scenario where the registrar outputs real personal data at the request and consent of the registrant, while the registry may not hold that real data. And so the registry will still output their placeholders or redacted information while the registry is publishing. And so, sorry, I'm just hearing a lot of background music.
That's to enhance your comment.
I think I've said what I need to. Thank you.
Margie, when you brought this up for discussion, were you recommending any changes to the wording in the temporary specification?
I don't know if I have a – do you have the language? As soon as commercially reasonable must – no, I was suggesting that we continue it. I think we need to have a little more clarity on what as soon as commercially reasonable means, but – apart from that, the remainder of it I thought should be the same.
I'm not sure I have a way. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I may be wrong. Provider's consent to publish the additional contact information outlined. I'm sorry. I don't remember what that was. I think it's consent to all... Oh, okay, yeah. So in other words, as long as it's consent to having the full SWIS contact added, that's what I'm talking about.
You know, I'm still kind of in a place where we're going to be requiring registrars to perform a service that's difficult for, say, a compliance regime to enforce because there's so many ways consent can be obtained. And in effect, if a registrar wanted to, it could avoid the requirement for offering the consent by making it expensive or difficult or some other way. And so, I'm just concerned about creating an obligation that is difficult to enforce. Thomas?
Thanks, Craig. Let me get back to my point of technical issues that I made earlier. Some of our team have established that the registries are the ultimate resource for confirming who a registered name holder is. So let's just assume that a registered name holder gives his or her consent to a given registrar. Then this case happens where we need the registry to act as the ultimate resource of who the registered name holder is and the data surrounding it. And how would the consent recorded by the registrar be transferred to the registry and be made available to another registrar who would then manage the domain name? How would we record the contents of that consent? So it's a genuine question. Maybe you have ideas on how this can be done technically. Also, if consent is given, how would this consent be withdrawn? How would we get it out of the system? What is the technical vehicle for transporting that consent or a withdrawal through the entire system and remove it from the data that is escrowed, from the data that's with the registry and the data that's with the registrar? I think we don't have the technical means yet. We don't have the technical language that is binding upon all the players, all the contracted parties. And so I generally think that this is something that that would need more work, more technical work. Transfers and all that stuff have not yet been discussed either. So I think that, you know, getting back to Ellen Woods' point, I think this is above and beyond what can be achieved during this EPDP. Thanks.
Thank you, Thomas. Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you very much. As I said before, maybe it doesn't need to be done by May 29th but it does need to be done within this ePDP. There's no other way. The answers to some of the technical questions are really easy. We're talking about changing the who is fields. We're talking about withdrawing some fields. We're talking about deciding whether we are going to publish even optionally the information. So there are elements that we're talking about. Those could be transmitted through EPP just the way they are right now. And the registry will respond. If the registrar says the registrant has withdrawn consent, then they transfer that information to the registry, and the registry will honor that information. In terms of how can we be sure, there is a contract between each registry and registrar. It's the RRA. That contract can require that the registrar certify that it has and can produce on demand the information on consent. It puts the onus on the registrar to do it properly, and that can be transferred via that contract. If you can't transfer these things by contracts, then how else can you do it? There's no. Are we talking about someone carrying a piece of paper with a signature on it? Other than that, electronic commerce allows us to do things electronically, and the contracts require us to do it and track it properly. I'm not sure I understand what the difficulty is. Thank you.
Go ahead, Mark.
Mark SB for the record. Similar to Ellen's comment, I do think the technical implementation issue is probably a red herring. It seems there's multiple ways to do this. You could do this at the registration level, or you could do this at the account level. I'm aware of somebody doing this at the account level where someone says at the purchase of, at the time of purchase, I'd like to have all my records unredacted. That doesn't even involve touching who is. So it seems there's multiple ways to do this. You could add another field to who is. You could handle this somewhere else in your relationship. It just seems like a distraction to argue about the implementation detail right now when it seems, as Alan says, so imminently doable within the state of the art.
So I think it's doable by registrars. What if a registrant wanted their data published by their registrar in one country, but not by the registry in another country, or something like that? Would that be a requirement for registrars to notify the registrants that, who will be publishing the data besides the registrar? And does that need to be a menu choice? So I see a geometric complication of issues associated with passing it on to the registry. Benedict, go ahead.
Hey, yeah. So Tucows gave this issue a huge amount of thought earlier this year. For full disclosure, they're my back end. I use their registrar management service, and they came up with a consent process basically where they ask the registrant what the registrant wants to do, and this was in place March. So basically, the registrant gets sent an email saying, or either asked at time of registration or if it's an existing domain, gets sent an email saying, do you consent to share your data with the registry? So it's about their consent to share their WHOIS data with the registry. And if they don't do that, then Tucows redacts the data sent to the registry, so the registry publishes redacted. And if they give their consent, the unredacted data is shared up and published by both. So they quite neatly tie the two issues together, that of sharing data up and of publication, in a way that they feel is GDPR compliant. And I'll post a quick link to their legal and technical interpretation, but. This has been working for me. I've been using this for 6 months now. So, and they've, their model seems to work quite efficiently. Yes, it does require an extra click of a button, but it's integrated into their registration process now. So for new domains, it works well going forward.
Thanks, Benedict. Go ahead, Mark.
Thanks, Kurt. It's Mark. My comments are somewhat similar to yours. I'm I do agree with what Mark SV said. I'm not sure that the technical issues are unsurmountable here. There are challenges there, particularly when it comes to withdrawing consent. There are some concerns I have around withdrawal of consent that are not straightforward at all, especially when you're dealing with three different parties here that have to manage the withdrawal of consent. So I think there are ways that this could be accomplished, but I think my point is why. I think to Kurt's point, if there's a use case, if there's somebody that wants to publish their data, this can be accomplished by the registrar at the registrar level, adding the additional complexity of transferring the data to the registry and requiring the registry to publish that data, adds a level of complexity and risk that I I'm not sure what value it provides. I don't think it provides any. I think it can be accomplished just fine at the registrar level. Somebody asked, I don't know if it was chat or on the call, can this be accomplished with, can't this be solved with RDAP? And yes, indeed, RDAP can provide, a single interface that can provide that data across multiple sources, such as registries and registrars. But, frankly, that can be accomplished with WHOIS as well. If you go to ICANN's WHOIS page, their WHOIS page does exactly that. It provides WHOIS output across registries and registrars where applicable. So I guess talking about the risk versus reward, I think adding this as an obligation on registries, I'm not sure the value it provides, and it creates additional risk and complexity that to me just doesn't justify that.
Thanks, Mark. So I don't know if anybody else has a comment or a recommendation. I hear the registrars on this call saying they're either already offering the service or probably intend to offer the service, but a reluctance to agree to the language that we have in the current temp spec. I don't know. Among the registrars, does the phrase commercially reasonable, does that temper your concern about making it a must? I think it's less eloquent worded this way, but but it provides a way for registrars to convince themselves that it's commercially reasonable. And I want to, before I turn it over to Sarah, I want to echo Margie's comment that if we included that, then we'd want to define that in some way. Go ahead, Sarah.
I have not had a chance to confer with my other stakeholder members who have left this call already, but for myself, I would say no. Having it the soon as commercially reasonable language does not make it okay for that to be a may. I see those as being two separate things. I think it's important to have the commercially reasonable line in there because we do need to remember small registrars especially have probably some limitations of resources for the ability to do development work in a quick manner, but still I think it should be a may, and I think that's a separate thing. Thank you.
So I'm going to bring the meeting to a close. I think, our only action item coming out of the, I'll try to make some sense out of this conversation and continue it as an email discussion, and particularly focus on, what happens if we continue to disagree on this point. What happens with the temp spec language, and what happens going forward? I am not sure. So I'm reading what Brian said. So I think our only action out of this call is that we put up in the chat room earlier a modification of the language in Appendix A 2.6 about privacy proxy services. So that has either already been sent out an email or will be shortly, and I want to get concurrence around that language because I think that seemed acceptable to most on this call. And maybe, you know, maybe a small team can work through it. So we'll think about that. Caitlin, were there any other action items?
Thanks. This is Caitlin for the transcript. And no, you captured all of them. Thank you.
Well, this. Okay, Benedict, I assume that's an old hand. Yeah, so thanks very much, everybody, for the constructive discussion. I'm sorry we didn't get to a conclusion on it. And I'll start a discussion on email and try to lay out the issues the best I can to see if we can get to some sort of agreement, what the effect of having no agreement is on this. So thanks very much. Have a great rest of your day.
And once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Operator, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.